I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This hour, we're going to have a couple of different conversations for you. I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We are talking in the first part of our program to Congressman John Paul Sarbanes. John Sarbanes represents the 3rd District in the U.S. Congress. And then later in the program, we're going to be talking about how this downturn is affecting nonprofits and why nonprofits are calling for a bailout of their own. So we'll go to the phones now and talk with John Sarbanes. Congressman, are you with us? Hello? Okay, well, I guess we'll have this all fixed up in a minute. And when we do, we'll go to the phones and talk with John Sarbanes. And you can all join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk here this hour about the bailout of the auto industry and other issues facing the U.S. Congress, but mostly about the bailout and whether or not we should be bailing out the auto industry here in America. So if you'll bear with us a minute, we'll come right back here with John Sarbanes. And he can join us. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. We will be on the air talking with them . Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to the program today. And we're talking to John Sarbanes, who is congressman from the 3rd Congressional District. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or write to us here at thesteinershow@gmail.com. And John Sarbanes, you with us?
Yes, I am, Mark. How you doing?
I'm well. There you go. Okay, sorry about that delay and a little mix-up. Good to have you with us. How are you?
Great. I think this is my first time on your show here, WAA.
The first time on the new show. It's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
We don't want you to be a stranger.
No, definitely not.
So let's talk about the bailouts. I think it's a good place to begin this conversation. The auto industry is in Annapolis asking for money. There have been a lot of people who have been writing that, well, let's just start with that some people are saying that whether or not you agree with these bailouts or not, that right. Compared to what's going on, what happened with the financial industry, that the auto industry is getting short shrift and being beaten up upon more than the finance industry, and they actually provide jobs and are building industry, and for whatever reason, they're not getting the same attention or benefit as the financial industry in this country.
Well, I think you got to look at each of these situations separately. I mean, there's analogies in that they both sort of fall under the bailout heading, if you want to term it that. But the thing that we did with respect to the financial industry was only partly about rescuing certain institutions or even, you know, certain slices of the financial industry. A lot of it had to do with, I mean, frankly, what motivated me was watching the credit markets tightening up from one day to the next and having this real concern that you'd get a total freeze in the credit market that would affect not just commercial credit, but would affect consumer credit, and you get to where businesses can't get short-term loans, small businesses can't make payroll, and then people have the prospect of credit cards being pulled back on them and so forth. So that was about really trying to address things systemic that was beginning to be seen in the economy in terms of this freezing of credit, and it looks like there has been some thawing of that as a result. This new discussion about the auto industry is about targeting a very specific industry and focused primarily on a significant number of jobs that could be lost and then the ripple effect that it could have across the economy. And we're not just talking about people on a plant floor losing a job if a Chrysler or GM or Ford goes down. We're talking about all of the suppliers to that industry. We're talking about people that move the cars. You saw the article yesterday in the Sun paper about the potential impact of Chrysler's failure that we could have on the port of Baltimore, which, you know, a lot of the cars are shipped out through mm-hmm. the port of Baltimore and so forth. So now we're talking about targeting specifically an industry which is so intertwined with the national economy that I think those of us, and I include myself among that group, who think we need to do something here to help get them through this stage, we're really concerned about the effect it could have. You know, upwards, by some estimates, upwards of 2.5 million jobs could potentially be at stake if these three companies were to fail.
It seems to me, though, a couple of levels here very quickly, and I want to open the phones because people are calling in with grave concerns of this. I can see from the screen about where we're going with the bailouts. But everything I've read so far in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, all the progressive press on the web, even the conservative and right-wing press on the web, is that this bailout we've given to the financial industry has very few strings attached, and that trillions have actually been given away when you look at all the other money going out besides what we've seen in public, and with very little regard to how they are forced to spend it or our oversight of them. It seems like this, and then people are saying that, look, and then the exact opposite is taking place in the audio industry, but who's bailing out the audio industry are the unions and the workers themselves at the moment who are saying we're going to give up our pensions, health care for the pensioners, that the new people coming into the audio industry are going to be making $14 an hour as opposed to $25 when the audio industry was the backbone of the growth of the middle class. I mean, it feels like we're facing a complete downturn in who we are as America.
Yeah. Well, I share the perspective that, you know, the auto industry is having to cross every I and or cross every T and dot every I in ways that arguably the financial industry was not subject to, and it's quote not fair. I think the way to deal with that is to continue to exert increasing oversight on the with respect to the financial rescue package, the $700 billion. And insist on some things that, at least in the initial stages, the Secretary Paulson, has not undertaken. For example, focusing more on the foreclosure dimension of that and trying to, I mean, you know, initially when he came to us, Mark, plan was to buy up some toxic assets, a fair number of them, in a way that you could get to the underlying
right.
Subprime mortgages, and give people some more flexibility there, restructure some of those things so you could keep people in their homes. Then he did a 180 and went to and there's reasons why this was the case. But he went into providing some recapitalization to some of the banks that were under siege. That had to do with trying to keep loosen up the credit. But I understand why people are upset because first of all, it's taxpayers' money. We can never forget that.
Right.
$700 billion in taxpayers' money, and it's going, you know, to a fund over which the secretary has a significant amount of discretion. Although I will say there's an inspector general that's in the process. There's a congressional oversight panel and so forth. We just got to continue to be aggressive with that oversight and make sure that the money is spent in a way that makes sense.
We're going to open the phones right after this question. Joy and Stephen, the first two callers up to get in this conversation with Congressman John Sarbanes. We're talking about the bailouts. Congress is debating now. Now the auto industry is there. The next 2 days, in intense discussions with U.S. Congress, our representatives, 410-319-8888. But when the new Congress arrives in January,
yeah,
with a Democratic president and a larger majority in the U.S. Congress and in the U.S. Senate, are we going to open up discussions about further restrictions on how we're doing this and on oversight with the financial industry and whoever else gets these bailouts?
Absolutely. I would think that would be right at the top of the agenda. First of all, you're also going to have a new Secretary of the Treasury. You're going to have a new administration. You're going to have an administration that frankly comes with the point of view that was seeking even greater restrictions when we were hammering this deal out with the administration, you know, 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago. So you're going to have a perspective that's much more interested in having these dollars spent, and then people in place who are responsible for spending the money, who are more interested in some of those issues I mentioned. What's happening on the foreclosure front? Making sure that banks that are getting the benefit of some of these dollars aren't simply taking it and either sitting on it, which has been one criticism, or using it to go buy up, other banks. So I think there's going to be much more scrutiny applied in the next administration, and we'll have people in place to share the kind of perspective that I'm sharing now and that I think a lot of your callers and listeners have.
Let's hear what they have to say, as a matter of fact. We're talking with Congressman John Sarbanes, 3rd District Congressman, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Your thoughts on the bailouts. What should Congress be doing? How do you want them to represent your interests and Joy in Baltimore? You're on the air. Hi, Joy, you there? Do we have Joy up? Like, I think, why don't we let Joy put her on hold? Sounds like she's someone else. Let's try Stephen in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello, yes. Good evening. My name's Stephen Feasey, and I'm with the Bail Out the People, Not the Banks campaign. And I have a question to the congressman, and kind of a rhetorical question is if we have almost to the tune of $3 trillion, if you include all the, you know, money that's been opened up through the Treasury and the Federal Reserve to banks or whatever, where is the political will from our leaders to provide remedies for poor and working people, from health care to stopping foreclosures?
Yes.
And also, you know, during the 30s, where is our leadership, you know, through the governors or even just the congressmen, because congressmen can speak and have a large voice, that, you know, just like you have natural disasters and you can call state of emergencies. Well, we're going through something like a state of emergency economically. And why isn't our elected officials, you know, demanding or whatever that emergency measures be taking place to stop layoffs, free a moratorium on foreclosures, to utility shutoffs, because people are right now are hurting. And I just want to say to your audience, to anyone that is interested in joining this campaign to put pressure on our elected officials to enact emergency measures, please come to the Solidarity Center on Mondays from 6 to 8 p.m. We have a campaign to actually address. So I just wanted to put that out there. Why isn't the political will to address the real
issue? I appreciate that question, because it allows me to talk about this discussion on the stimulus package, which, you know, the Democrats, even as Secretary Paulson was coming through the door and saying, I need $700 billion to engineer this financial rescue plan, we were saying, wait a second, if you think we can come up with $700 billion for that kind of plan, then certainly you should be open to a significant stimulus package that can go directly to the kind of thing you're talking about, preserving jobs, getting money out to the states and to the municipalities. Of course, what's happening with this economy, as you look around, it's happening in Maryland too. Many, many states, most, I think, are suffering from significant budget deficits because their revenues are down, their tax revenues are down, and they're looking at having to make cuts. The Democrats from the beginning, and some Republicans, but it was largely a Democratic initiative, and continuing to this day, have been arguing we need a major stimulus package that puts money into infrastructure projects, that goes directly to states and municipalities to help them retain a lot of the human resource functions, perform, et cetera. That's going to preserve jobs. Infrastructure projects, new energy technology projects, and other things like that are going to create jobs. And the president-elect, Obama, has been talking about a major stimulus package, even trying to have a proposal together so that when we come back in January, he can put that forward to the Congress. We can ratify it and then get it back to his desk for signature. So this kind of immediate assistance can be there. I get very upset that somehow we're able to put taxpayer money to work when it comes to these rescue plans, which so far I've viewed as necessary to do. But if we can do those, certainly we can put some significant resources behind a stimulus and recovery package for working people across the country.
John Sarbanes is our guest for this first part of our show. Of course, 3rd District Congressman, talking about the bailout and other issues facing Congress. The auto industry is there now. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Joyce in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Joyce. You're on the air.
Yes. First, I need to ask the question. Is Chrysler Financial owned by Chrysler Auto?
If you're asking me that question, I'm not sure. I assume it's an affiliated company. It sounds like it's one of the auto financing companies, which is generally an arm of these operations.
One of the auto companies I know, I don't know if it was GM or Chrysler, spun that off, but I'm not sure if it was Chrysler or GM. I can't remember off the top of my head, Joyce. Joyce, you there? Did we lose Joyce again? All right, well, 410-319-8888. We'll come back to the phones here, 410-319-8888, as we look at the bailout. But a couple of questions, John, as we're looking at this. One is that we're talking about a lack of revenues and having to bail out these industries and trying to design a plan that would re-stimulate the economy. Yet there's all kinds of rumors that the tax increase on the wealthiest citizens of America, the president-elect Obama talked about during the campaign, is not being hedged upon.
Is not being what?
Hedged upon. The commitment to that seems to be not as strong as it was during the rhetoric of the campaign.
Is now being hedged upon.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard that. I mean, I think probably what you've picked up on is economists are probably weighing in and suggesting that the timetable for implementing that kind of increase in our tax revenues by hiking it on people over $250,000 has to be pursued carefully, because you don't want to shock the economy from another point in time, which I generally agree with. But I have to say that people at the very highest income levels have had such a break for so long, and I think are in a position, frankly, to absorb a little bit more responsibility for contributing to the Treasury, that I wouldn't want to see much of a delay on that front, because, you know, that is going to represent some revenue. But let's not pretend. It remains the case that if you don't have a strong middle class, then you don't have a strong engine that's driving the economy. And so as much as we can try to reclaim some tax revenue from those in the highest income brackets, and we ought to go do that, we got to make sure that we're preserving jobs in the middle class, because, you know, that is the engine that makes our economy strong. And that's where the neglect has been for so many years.
Now, I'm going to get, there's an email here, and there's like five callers. We have like 10 minutes, so I want to get all these calls in and get to this. But I mean, it seems to me that when I read about the auto industry right now, with an average auto worker's pay is like $28 an hour. In the new auto industry, in the Honda and Toyota in this country, is like $25 an hour. But the difference comes in the health benefits. They pay fewer benefits and less money in pension for a Honda and Toyota in America, while the big three pay a great deal more. And so it seems to me many people are arguing that the underpinning of all the problem here when it comes to the auto industry is healthcare.
Right.
And that if you don't wrestle with healthcare, you can't do anything with the auto industry or anybody else.
Well, it's an excellent point to make, Mark, because it may be the best argument for why it's not fair to let the auto industry fail here. Because I think that the healthcare costs, those legacy costs, point to a bigger failure. They point to a failure that's larger than the auto industry. They point to a failure with respect to our overall healthcare system and, frankly, our pension system. And you know, there's a decent argument to be made when you look at what's in place in some of our the countries that we compete with around the world, that we don't really have a pension system in this country to speak of, and we certainly don't have a decent healthcare system. My view is those costs, healthcare, pension, are ones that should be shared through a public-private partnership in this country. I think we've never had that kind of commitment in a way that would solve the problem. But, you know, if the auto industry tried to do the right thing by providing healthcare coverage and retirement benefits and so forth to its workers, and that was largely because of the advocacy that came through collective bargaining, so credit has to be given there. But if they were trying to do the right thing, when other employers and other industries around the country have not done that, why should they be punished for that
if we've got this larger problem. And that's why what I would like to see is let's see if we can get the industry through, get them across the river, if you will. Obviously, they've got to make certain things happen. They've got to become more efficient. They've got to restructure. They've got to streamline. They've got to put new, more efficient product lines out there. I mean, they've got a lot to do and a lot to demonstrate. But let's get them through to a point where they're engaged in that side of the bargain, and we're looking at how to build a better system of health care and retirement benefits in this country across the board that then industries like the auto industry and other industries can benefit from.
Let me get the phones here and read this email on the way to the phones. I, for one, think the bailouts are a scam. Supposedly we're a free market country. It seems only when companies make profits. The larger problem is that corporations have overcompensated their top people. I had to report to stockholders and their profit expectations. The worker suffers. Specifically in regard to the big three, they made huge profits selling Americans cheap to produce high-profit SUVs while gas prices went up and up. And had they actually developed cars responsibly and their eye towards quality and keeping their companies solvent, they wouldn't be in so deep a situation now. As a self-employed person, I find it sickening that America rewards irresponsibility in the backs of people who are forced by the law and budget to try to do the right thing.
The critique in that email is right on. I'm not going to disagree with it, but I would, in terms of the conclusion that's drawn, I'd go a different direction. I'd say, look, what's happened is this crisis has finally woken up both management and labor within this industry. They're coming scared to the table, but they're coming to the table with minds that are much more open to change and dramatic restructuring than they ever had before. Let's take advantage of that and see if we can get them through this phase and then make them stick to the plans that they're putting forward, which they came forward with today to the Senate Banking Committee.
410-319-8888. John Sarbanes, our guest for the next few minutes. And Tavon, you're on the air.
Hello, good evening, Mr. Hey. My question for this evening is, with the auto industry come in asking for so much money, why haven't there been any stipulations put on them as far as building cars? Like right now, if you drive by a car lot, every car lot is full with cars. There should be some type of cap on how many cars can be built per year, because it seems like the market is being over flooded, and if people had to wait a week or two to actually offset some of the costs of the auto industry had to incur, I think most people wouldn't have no problem with that. That pretty much was my question/statement. I'll take my answer off the air as well.
Thanks, Tavon. Glad you joined us. John Sarbanes?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at the plans that were presented today, it includes some of the things that you're talking about. I mean, clearly, when they came 2-3 weeks ago, a lot of these executives, unfortunately, were still living in the bubble because, as you know, they showed up on their private jets, and then they were expecting the government to give them a handout. They drove to Washington today in their hybrid vehicles. I guess it's all part of a show, but at least they got that part of the message from 2 weeks ago. But they're coming with proposals that are pretty dramatic in terms of what they are agreeing needs to have happen. And they understand that they missed the mark. They missed what was happening out there. And then, of course, we had the oil shock and the price of gas went up, and everybody looked around and said, where are the fuel-efficient cars that we need? I got to say, Mark, not only did the industry miss the mark, but it's appropriate to point the finger to Washington and to policymakers. The fact that we have not been able to put more stringent CAFE standards and higher mileage and efficiency standards in place for years and years within the political realm and in the policymaking realm, you know, it's shame on Washington policymakers as far as that goes, because they weren't pushing the industry to meet higher standards. I think that's going to change, too. That's an important point to make here. It's not just that the auto industry is suddenly woken up because they're getting scared straight here, okay?
Right.
But it's also that you're having a changing of the guard. I think you're going to have people, you know, in this new administration and also in the Congress, there's some real changes going on. We saw it last week when Henry Waxman became chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is where a lot of these fuel efficiency pieces of legislation go through. And I think you're going to see a more aggressive agenda there. So it's both a wake-up call that finally the industry is getting the picture, but also policymakers in Washington are beginning to realize we got to get out on the cutting edge. One of the things that drives me crazy, Mark, is I keep seeing these commercials on television for American cars, and at the end of the commercial, with all this fanfare and music playing, they talk about how the car is going to get 30 miles per gallon on the highway. Like that's some big accomplishment in 2008 in this world. That's evidence on its face that we're behind the ball. We need to be getting way out in front on this thing. I think the industry's getting it finally, but we're going to keep pushing them as policymakers in Washington on that.
Let's have a couple more calls here before you have to go. We have to take a break. Of course, if you watch football games, all they do is push trucks. 410-319-8888. Russ in East Baltimore, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ.
You know, there's a lot I'd like to talk about, but let me say first that Chrysler Financial is wholly owned by the hedge fund that bought Chrysler. They are a private company, privately held.
GM Thank you for that.
GM sold a 51% share of GMAC, which is their financial arm, and I forget to whom they sold that, but that's the situation with them. But what's concerning me today is we're missing some larger issues, I think, because we're talking about more bailouts, we're talking about more stimulus packages, and I'm just wondering at what point do we get the message that leverage and over-leveraging is what's caused our fundamental problem. When you look at it, we're not talking about the credit default swap the way we should be, because that's the heart of the problem. You got $55 trillion of credit default insurance, which should have been regulated, chasing a commercial paper market that's only worth $5 trillion. So that brings me to the point of if it's what's true for companies is true of countries. This country right now, we have about a $30 trillion deficit to Social Security that we owe. It's going to take about another $30 trillion to pay the out years of Medicare and Medicaid. We have a current account deficit of about $13 trillion with the last $3 trillion we've added
right. This
bailout. And we have a trade account deficit that's around $5, $10 trillion. So when you look at the total numbers, you're talking about being about $70, $80, $100 trillion in debt. On our GDP is about $15 million. So I'm just wondering who's going to bail out the United States at the end of the day.
Russ, this is a very powerful question. We should do an entire show on this with our congressional delegation, but let me let John take a crack at it.
Well, actually, I just wanted to say amen to everything the caller just said. I mean, he's identified, as he says, the larger problem, which is we've been completely undisciplined in this country. Arguably, both personally, when you look at personal finances in this country, we have a negative savings rate, and in terms of the way government has conducted itself. But I'm not going to let this administration off the hook, the administration we've had for the last 8 years, because when they started out, we had a surplus going out as far as the eye could see. And within 2 years, they completely flipped that around. And now we're talking about $12 trillion in debt. And basically what happened was, we had fiscal policy that didn't work. We had monetary policy that didn't work. And we had tax policy. Can you still hear me, Mark?
Yeah, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. And so all of the basic economic stewardship that you need to have to run a country and do the right thing was thrown out the window. And it was thrown out the window in favor of special interests and in favor of the wise guys on Wall Street and so forth. And now we're paying the piper for it. We got to get back to some sensible kind of regulation, particularly when it comes to the financial industry. We've had a lot of hearings in the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. We've looked at all sorts of things in terms of the credit default swaps and the mortgage-backed securities and all these fancy derivatives. It's very simple at the end of the day. People got greedy and they overreached. And a lot of people got hurt along the way. And I just want to mention this, Mark. In one of the hearings, we had Alan Greenspan come in and testify.
Right.
His philosophy is, well, let the free market do what it wants. What will happen is if people act badly and recklessly, they'll get hurt, and they'll learn from their mistakes. It's sort of like you say, well, somebody gets in a car, and they drive recklessly, and they crash the car, and they get hurt. Then they'll know not to drive recklessly next time. The problem with that philosophy, the problem with not regulating them on the front end, the problem with not having a speed limit, and not making them wear their seatbelt and all the rest of it, to continue this metaphor, is, yeah, they may crash the car and hurt themselves, and they may learn in the process, but meanwhile, they've run over hundreds of innocent bystanders. In this case, you can argue they've run over millions of innocent bystanders, and that's in the form of all these people that are losing their homes, that are facing the foreclosures. It's not acceptable. You got to make sure people follow certain rules on the front end, or else we're going to just be cleaning up on the back end, and that's what happened.
Congressman Johns Harbaugh, thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you very soon, and from Washington and here. Thank you very much.
All right, take care, Mark.
Been a pleasure. We've been talking to Congressman John Sarbanes. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back from that short break, first we'll hear our piece again by Rosa Parks, about Rosa Parks from the Maryland Humanities Council, that we produced here at Center for Emerging Media for WEA here at Morgan State University. We're going to talk to Teresa DiCrescenzo and others about the other bailout that's not taking place, nonprofits that employ tens of millions of people and are really important to the future of this country, are going to the wasteland because of the crisis in the economy. We'll talk about that with her and some folks here from Baltimore. You can go to our website and read her bailout during the break, or the article she wrote on our website, steinershow.org. We'll be right back. Stay with us, and we'll continue this conversation. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're going to continue to talk about bailouts in America, but let's talk about an angle we don't often think about. One of our producers here on the Mark Steiner Show, Jessica Phillips, found a piece written for the Boulder Daily Camera, I believe, in Colorado, by Teresa DiCrescenzo. Did I pronounce your name right, Teresa?
Yes.
Thank you. That's good. Who's our guest, one of our guests today, who wrote, "Where's the Bailout for Nonprofits?" And then we start looking at a number of other articles in the state of nonprofits in our country, and realizing the powerful role that nonprofits play in the social welfare and more of our nation and our state here in Maryland. In Maryland alone, we were looking at some statistics, and nonprofits in Maryland, one out of every 10 jobs in the state of Maryland is a job with a nonprofit. One out of every 10 jobs. And we're looking at new nonprofits every day being formed in Maryland, and billions of dollars of money we're talking about here, and jobs that also generate $10.6 billion in wages, or 8.5% of the entire payroll in the state of Maryland comes out of nonprofits. They do all the work that we never hear about but always hear about. Social workers who get underpaid but are dedicated and stay even when they're underpaid, and more. So we're going to talk about what is the effect of all this on our nonprofits. Well, Teresa joins us, who wrote the article. She's executive director of GLASS, Youth and Family Services, based in Burbank, California. And her piece, I said again, is "Where's the Bailout for Nonprofits?" You can go to our blog at steinershow.com and org to read her blog. Mike Mitchell's in studio, who is the CEO of Chesapeake Habitat for Humanity, and Teresa DiCrescenzo and Mark Mitchell, good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. So set up for us, Teresa, your argument about nonprofits that you made and your very passionate piece that you wrote.
Well, Mark, you know, the facts speak for themselves. The low wages that nonprofits make, the services we provide that no one else can or will provide. And then I hear, you know, I feel like singing Little Deuce Coupe about, you know, the good times are about to roll again in Detroit. Bailout, billions and billions and billions of dollars of bailouts for private industries that were so badly mismanaged, and these guys get these $20 million golden handshakes as they go out the door. And all I'm saying is there ought to be an underpinning, a basic amount of money that's available to nonprofits when we get into what we call donor fatigue, and in this economy, it's more like donor exhaustion. We rely on these government contracts. We don't just rely on fundraising, and the government contracts just get cut at will. I was in the middle of a contract a couple of years ago. I had actually rented office space, a three-year lease, which was the length of the contract. It was a $20,000 a month contract to provide long-term family self-sufficiency to underprivileged families with adolescents who were at adrift, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first year, I got a letter. It wasn't just me. Everyone got it when I did something wrong. They said, well, thanks for your services. We've decided we don't have enough money for this program anymore. And I spent 2 years paying on an empty office because I had a three-year lease to go with a three-year contract. They just give, take, cut, slash, and then you're left holding the bag.
Mike Mitchell, how does that play out here for us in Maryland and for you, do you think?
You know, it's a big concern, the decline in the economy. I'd say that what we've seen at Habitat are individual donations have actually gone up. And if you look at recessions since 1967, giving actually goes up for human services. But the problem is that government funding is not flexible and also goes down.
But, I mean, we're facing a situation now where we're about to see the governor of this state and the governor of most every other state in the nation is going to talk about a cut in human services, a cut in all across the board.
Exactly.
And those are the cuts that affect human beings' lives, every day of their lives, and affects the nonprofits who do a lot of the work, who then contract with the state to do this work, whether it's foster care, working with their at-risk kids, working in halfway houses for people coming out of prisons, working to rebuild houses in the inner city. Whatever that work is, you can go across the board, protecting stray animals, whatever it might be. And that, Teresa, I think we're not really thinking about what the effect of all this is going to be on that, and where's the bailout, you're saying, for nonprofits working in issues of poverty and growth in America.
Well, exactly. And if you noticed in my article, I said we went 9 years without a raise, and now we're going to get a cut. 9 years of flat funding. I don't have to tell anybody in 9 years the cost of wages go up, the cost of health benefits go up, the cost of workers' compensation, you know, you name it, it goes up. And yet we got flat funding year after year. There is not a single industry in this country, I don't care if you're running a little boutique, a mom-and-pop grocery store, or AIG. You can't go 9 years with flat funding. You'll collapse, and we finally are about to collapse under the weight of it. And if I don't get a bailout, and P.S., it's $3 or $4 million I need, not B as in boy, billion. If I don't get a bailout within the next month or two, 200 employees will be out of work, and all the families we serve will be without our services.
And how many thousands of people does affect the families you serve, do you think?
Well, we have hundreds of families on our caseload. We have a family preservation program where we try to keep kids from coming into the crummy, damaged, ruined foster care system, a broken system, if there ever was one in this country, is the foster care system. So we have what we call IHOCs, in-home counselors, who work with these families to keep these kids from having to leave the homes. We put a social worker in a home 4 or 5 hours a day. And then, yes, we do have the full spectrum. We also have the foster homes. Again, foster parents getting paid, they said in my article, less than it costs about $1,000 a month at $35 a day to kennel a dog. And the maximum we pay for special needs kids in foster homes is about $750,
$800.
Mark, let me just say, before you jump in, that line in your piece, it's really, I mean, it goes to the heart of not just the cuts in social services, but where we place the importance.
Exactly.
And this is, let me just read the line that you just referred to, that a national study found that foster parents are paid less than the cost to kennel a dog. Foster children are given less care. We pay less for that than we do for a dog in a kennel. I love dogs.
But, Mark, let me start hearing from your listeners. I have two dogs. I adore them.
Right.
So I don't want any animal
rights. Well, no. I'm an animal nut. But, you know, 410-319-8888. Join us here. We've been talking earlier in the hour about bailing out the auto industry with one of our congressmen, John Sarbanes from the 3rd District. We're talking about this. What about the bailout for human services? What about the bailout for people in education and our schools and what we do every day? What are your thoughts about that, and what are we willing to do about it? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Teresa DiCrescenzo, who is Executive Director of Glass Youth and Family Services in Burbank, California. The reason she joins us today is because of her piece, Where's the Bailout for Nonprofits, that she wrote. You can read it on our website now at steinershow.org. We're also joined by Mike Mitchell, CEO of the Chesapeake Habitat for Humanity here, 410-319-8888. And Mike, you were about to say something. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say what the crisis highlights for all of us is that it allows middle-class people to see what our clients face on a day-to-day basis. You look at the families that come into Habitat, their energy bills are going up, their food bills are going up, so they have more and more of a need for services like our organizations. That's what our organizations do every day.
And well, I guess what shocks me in all this when we talk about the bailouts is that when we during the campaign, President-elect Obama talked about taxing the wealthy a bit more, but what we never talk that then they are taxed now to raise some more and not taxing the most of us who are not wealthy in America. And the rub here is that the billions of dollars, actually hundreds of billion dollars in taxes are going to waste, is on the wealth that's never taxed. We don't tax capital gains. We don't tax the money where the real wealth is. We only tax wages. We don't tax real wealth. And that, Teresa, and me, is one of the things it's one of the hidden discussions in America that most people don't think are aware of.
For sure. The governor in our state, after slashing $500 million, and we're looking at more, as he's still unhappy with the social service budget, it took a public outcry for him to take the $45 million yacht exemption, luxury yacht exemption. Why would you give somebody a tax break because they own a yacht? I mean, it's just senseless. The priorities are all wrong. And it goes without saying, in the last 8 years of this administration, the wealthy have been catered to, and begin to think that they're above it all. And that's why you've had so much, I think we've had so much official legal corruption. I don't just mean the sort of corrosive stuff that happens behind closed doors, but people who've been arrested and tried and brought to trial and found guilty of horrific crimes involving money, because you begin to feel you're above it all. You're immune to, you're inoculated against having to follow the rules like the rest of us.
There's a piece I read in somebody else's article that was it went to the Washington Post that came out last Friday, or the Friday right after Thanksgiving. And there are 1 million nonprofits in the United States of America, and they say over 100,000 could fail this year because of the lack of funding. It's not just government funding, because a lot of the nonprofits get money from foundations. Foundations, absolutely, because of the crash, have lost one-third to one-quarter of their funds.
Yeah, Mark, yep. I can even say that at Habitat, we've seen a decline in corporate giving because the money that they've got is going down. Foundation money is going down because their corpus is going down. So they've got less money to give
their
out.
Their corpus means they're
the money that they use to give out,
right,
that it's based on. So as that goes down, we're more and more dependent on individuals.
I'm sorry, Teresa, you're trying to say something, then we'll open the phones here.
I think the issue is that our corporate and foundation, we've had some very generous foundations in the past, and I've called them, and one foundation said, you know, our endowment has gone from 8, B as in boy, billion, to about 7 billion, and so they're not so eager to renew their gift to us. So we're hurting all the way around, individually, corporate, corporate foundation, and now the government. And I think the government has to be held responsible. Yes, we look to private foundations and individuals for their generosity, but I think the government has to be held accountable too.
Folks, what do you think? We're talking here about the effect that no one is talking about in America right now of this downturn, which happens to nonprofits who do much of the social service work and creative rebuilding of homes in our communities and much more work in the environment. And we could lose all that. If we lose all that, it could mean thousands of jobs being lost in the state of Maryland, hundreds of thousands of jobs around the country being lost, maybe millions. As well as the effect on people who receive those services. 410-319-8888 is the number here, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Joe in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good evening.
Joe.
I'm like probably a lot of your listeners, driving home from work. Left early this morning, won't be home for another hour. And I'm a hardworking American, and I have to tighten up my belt. I think everybody should tighten up their belt. And there's a lot of us out here that work very, very hard that are tired of hearing about a bailout for anybody. So I have a lot of empathy, and I really appreciate what those nonprofits do. But it's a time where everyone has to tighten their belt, and we can't bail out everybody. Everybody has to do their own part, and if things are tight, they need to figure another way to raise funds.
hold on here. Let me ask your caller. Sir, hardworking American as you are, and I applaud you and I salute you, have you had a raise in the last 9 years?
I work for myself, so I get a raise when I work harder and I do, and I bring in more business. So,
do you have employee? I'm at maximum capacity. I can't bring in any more business. I can't bring in any more business. And I ask you, do you have employees? Have you given them any raises in 9 years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My employees are paid probably 20% more than the industry average.
Hey, Joe, one of the things that I would say to you is that nonprofits aren't just handing out money. We're investing in communities. The Habitat chapter that I run employs 23 people. We've got contractors, subcontractors. In addition to that, we're building houses throughout Baltimore. We're building up a tax base, and those taxes are coming back to the government, making neighborhoods safer. So it's not just charity per se. We're investing in communities. So the loss of those nonprofits is a loss for neighborhoods that might be near you, might be in your communities, and the taxes that go to support the schools that you might send your children to.
Right. Now, I appreciate what you all do, like I said, but I think people, as we hear more and more over time, and I spend probably 2 hours a day in the car commuting back and forth to the Washington, D.C. area, mm-hmm. people hear about everybody getting bailed out, the car industry, this industry, the financial industry. Everybody wants more and more, when a lot of Americans are standing on their own feet, 2 feet, taking care of themselves. We never ask for anything, and it's just a little level of frustration with that. And I think that's why I know I give to a lot of different foundations and donations. And we got a call the other day from the Williamsburg Foundation that we always give to, and I had a long day, and I said, you know what, I'm not ready to make another donation right now. Thank you very much. So I think part of the problem is when Americans that have a little bit of extra discretionary income and want to give when they...
I'm sorry, we didn't cut you off. We just must have lost him on the road. If you want to, I apologize for that. It must have been a signal loss. But what Joe was saying is important. I mean, people see everybody getting bailed out in America, and people are working hard for a living. And everybody's kind of weary of it all, I think.
I mean, you were talking about the auto industry earlier. I mean, the big question when they first came, is it a bailout or a loan? And what does the government get back? Where do taxpayers get back? If money went to nonprofits, it would be fair for the public to say, what are we going to get back for that? Are we going to get safer communities? Are we going to get better schools? That's something that would be worthwhile. So maybe the term bailout isn't the right term to use.
Maybe investment is the word to use.
Yeah.
410-319-8880 is the number here. We'll come back to the phones. Teresa, maybe that is the problem. Maybe it's the nomenclature we use.
Maybe so. Maybe, of course, I was clearly, you know, doing a play on words in the sense that I was using that word. But the fact is, what people get when I and my staff do our job well, we get children who don't enter the juvenile justice system and don't end up costing $45,000, $50,000 a year to keep in prison when they become young adults. You get children who are more responsible citizens. You get families that are remaining intact. I mean, what cluck for the buck when you invest in a nonprofit organization? The return is, and I don't mean some sort of airy-fairy, feel-goody stuff that everybody is do-goody. I'm talking about concrete things. Our communities are safer and stronger when kids don't go into foster care system, when they don't go into the juvenile justice system, when families stay together. These are tangibles. We can measure and we can evaluate them dollar for dollar. One of the programs I talked about in my article is a brilliant program that takes homeless adults who are persistently mentally ill, works with them. We did the math. They saved tens of thousands of dollars in keeping them out of psychiatric hospitals, whereas if they fall between the cracks, they go into psychiatric hospitals, which is my other pet peeve, is the cost shifting. They say, yeah, well, look, we cut this service and this budget. It means it's off my plate, but it's on someone else's plate because somebody's going to pay for these people.
Let me go back to the phone. I think that's one of the problems that the social services and other people always have a hard time arguing, which is kind of convince society and government that you should be putting money at the front end, not the back end.
Right.
One of the most difficult things they get accomplished in this country for some reason. 410-319-8888. Lawrence in White Marsh, you're on the air. What happened? We just lost Lawrence?
Cell phones must be busy today.
I don't know. Lawrence, try to call back. We want to get you back on. 410-319-8888. But, I mean, that is part of the problem, because it becomes almost intangible for people to kind of put their hands around what exactly is the worth. You know, and I think that oftentimes in America that we equate the work of nonprofits and social and human services as helping those who won't help themselves.
Yes.
And that's the perception, I think, and that's the perception that you all are battling against.
That's the myth, and that's the myth. And, you know, you come across the homeowners that come to our program. There are people that make $8 or $9 an hour. They are working as a cashier. They're working in a hospital, and they are investing in society. And it's our job as citizens to make sure they can become stakeholders in that society.
410, do you want to make a comment on that, Teresa? I'm sorry.
That's such an important myth, you know, the myth of the welfare queen, staying at home and having tons of babies and living off the fat of the land is just that. It's a myth. When President Clinton signed the Workforce Opportunity Act in 1996, and he called it the end of welfare as we know it,
right.
We no longer have AFDC. We have TANF, and it's Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. So the work we do, I mean, is in the streets, literally in the streets, and in the homes of people. So it is not lazy people who won't help themselves. That's just really a. It's sometimes people who are challenged to help themselves if they're persistently mentally ill, in particular, emotionally disturbed, and so on.
We're talking about what this economic downturn means to nonprofits, and while we look at bailing out Big Auto and finance especially, what about those on the ground who work with the neediest? 410-319-8888. Let's try this one again. Lauren, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to share a comment. I support nonprofits totally. I think they do wonderful work. But I think this may be an opportunity to look into other ways to fund the nonprofit industry, because there are some contradictions in receiving funding to basically clean up a lot of the work, a lot of the problems that the corporate community causes in our society, and receiving all the funding to do that from the corporate community. And so I just think maybe this is a way, like we were talking about the auto industry, getting a wake-up call and looking into some other things. Maybe the nonprofit industry can do that also, because I heard a title of an article recently. It's called The Nonprofit, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. And so if we really want sustainable change for our world and our community, we can't go to the people who I think are creating so many of the problems that exist in our community.
That's a really interesting point, Lauren. I've got to find that article. Mike, go ahead.
I think there's a lot of blame to go around. I think governments don't always do a good job of distributing funds. I think that companies, there are a lot of good companies out there, and there are a lot of good people at those companies, and we come across them every day. So, but it's a good point.
Teresa?
Well, I still argue that, first of all, what we do very cost effectively. In the congressional hearings this morning, we heard how the average American worker makes $18 an hour, and the average worker in the auto industry earns $28 an hour.
Teresa, I'm sorry. This has been really great to have you on the show. Teresa DiCrescenzo, go to our website, read her article, Where's the Bailout for Nonprofits? Mike Mitchell, CEO of Chesapeake Habitat. Humanity, thank you both so much for being here.
You bet. Thank you, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our help today is from Christina Arison. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.